From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! We're on the road in Boston, Massachusetts.
Changes and progress very rarely are gifts from above. They come out of struggles from below. And it's up to the answer to what's next depends on people like you.
Today, the MIT professor and author Noam Chomsky joins us to talk about the global financial crisis and the G20, the NATO summit, the war in Afghanistan, Israel and Palestine, and much more. But first, University of Utah student Tim DeChristopher is charged with two felonies for disrupting the auction of over 100,000 acres of federal land for oil and gas drilling. He faces up to 10 years in prison. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The G20 summit ended in London Thursday with a pledge to overhaul financial regulation and spend more than $1 trillion in loans to struggling economies. In a 9-page declaration, G20 leaders outlined a series of voluntary steps, including regulating hedge funds, cracking down on tax havens, and increasing international lending. Funding for the International Monetary Fund was quadrupled with a $1 trillion commitment. Despite touting the financial pledges as aid for developing economies, the new money could actually be funneled back into the donor economies. The Washington Post reports a $250 billion G20 line of credit to increase liquidity will mostly go to the United States, Europe, and Japan. The U.S. alone could draw upon as much as $42.5 billion. In France, clashes erupted at a protest Thursday ahead of today's opening of NATO's 60th anniversary summit. Police used tear gas and rubber bullets against hundreds of protesters in the city of Strasbourg, where the meeting is taking place. Some protesters pelted officers with bottles and rocks. Thousands of police officers are on hand as protests continue over the two-day summit. Ahead of the meeting, a group of aid organizations has issued an appeal to NATO leaders, warning that an increased military occupation of Afghanistan will lead to a rise in civilian deaths. In a new report, 11 groups, including Oxfam and ActionAid, say, quote, too many military operations by foreign troops involve excessive force, loss of life, and damage to property. Here in the United States, a federal judge has ruled three prisoners at a U.S. military jail in Afghanistan can challenge their detentions in U.S. courts. The three were seized in foreign countries and brought to Afghanistan, where they've been confined at the Bagram Air Force Base for at least 6 years. There are about 650 prisoners at Bagram, but it appears the ruling would only grant habeas corpus to those seized abroad. The decision marked a loss for the Obama administration, which has mirrored the Bush administration in seeking to deny the prisoners' habeas corpus rights. Ramzi Qasem, an attorney for one of the prisoners with the International Justice Network, said, quote, this is a great day for American justice. A U.S. federal judge ruled that our government cannot simply kidnap people and hold them beyond the law, he said. In Illinois, a federal grand jury has charged former Governor Rod Blagojevich in connection with the alleged corruption that forced his removal from office. On Thursday, Blagojevich was charged with racketeering, extortion, and fraud. His brother and four other associates were also charged. Blagojevich was impeached in January following his indictment on bribery and wire fraud charges. The allegations against him include trying to sell President Obama's vacant Senate seat to the highest bidder. On Capitol Hill, lawmakers have approved President Obama's $3.5 trillion budget plan. The vote was split along party lines, save for 20 Democrats who joined Republican Congress members in voting against Senate Democrats, say they expect to pass their version of the bill later today. The House, meanwhile, has voted to grant regulators new authority to oversee the tobacco industry. The measure would allow the Food and Drug Administration to reject new tobacco products, bar additives, and restrict advertising. The measure is likely to face a Republican filibuster in the Senate. The former head of the bailed-out insurance giant AIG testified on Capitol Hill Thursday. Maurice Greenberg defended his role in steering AIG and blamed his successors after he left the company in 2005.
AIG's business model did not fail. Its management did. AIG's business model has a long track record of success over many decades. AIG can recover from its immediate crisis, continue to be an employer of tens of thousands of hardworking Americans, and repay the assistance that it's received from the American taxpayer, but only if both the government and AIG's management change their approach in dealing with its future.
Greenberg has come under wide criticism for running AIG when it helped create many of the complex financial instruments that caused the current economic collapse. In Denver, a jury has found the University of Colorado wrongfully dismissed Professor Ward Churchill 2 years ago. Churchill sued the school after he was fired from a tenured position on charges of research misconduct. But Churchill maintains the allegations were a pretext to remove him for his political beliefs. In 2005, he described the September 11th attacks as a response to a long history of U.S. abuses and called those who were killed in 9/11 as little Eichmanns. On Thursday, the jury said Churchill had been fired in large part for his views, but it only granted him $1 damages, along with ordering the University of Colorado to pay his attorney fees. Churchill's lawyers say they'll ask the judge to reinstate him at his old job. Here in New York, a pair of social justice groups are teaming up for a two-day protest that begins today. The Bail Out the People movement and United for Peace and Justice are planning to march on Wall Street to protest the financial bailout and the ongoing U.S. occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan. Tomorrow's event is being held on the anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King's assassination on April 4, 1968, in Memphis, where he traveled to lead a march of striking sanitation workers. It's also the anniversary of Dr. King's Beyond Vietnam speech, delivered at New York's Riverside Church 1 year earlier, on April 4, 1967. New figures show a record 32.2 million, or 1 in 10 Americans, are receiving food stamps. The government's figure for January marked the third record food stamp enrollment in 5 months. In Sudan, the Obama administration's new special envoy made his first visit on Thursday since his appointment last month. Retired Air Force General Scott Gratian pledged to seek cooperation with Sudanese officials in addressing the humanitarian crisis in Darfur.
The United States and Sudan want to be partners, and so we're looking for opportunities for us to build a stronger bilateral relationship. And I come here with my hands open, and it will be up to the Sudanese government to determine how they want to continue with that relationship. Hopefully, it will be with a hands of friendship, hands of cooperation.
And in East Timor, investigators are believed to have found the first bodies of protesters gunned down by U.S.-backed Indonesian forces in the Dili massacre of 1991. It was November 12, 1991, that Indonesian troops opened fire on a crowd of several thousand unarmed Timorese civilians gathered at the Santa Cruz Cemetery. At least 271 people were killed, but no bodies were found. The Victorian Institute of Forensic Medicine says it's dug up 16 bodies from unmarked graves at Hera, near Dili. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're here in Boston. In a moment, we'll be joined by Professor Noam Chomsky. He is joining us here in a Watertown studio. But first, we're going out to Utah for an update on the case of Tim DeChristopher. In December, the University of Utah student disrupted the Bush administration's last-minute move to auction off oil and gas exploitation rights on 150,000 acres of federal land in Utah. DeChristopher was arrested after he posed as a bidder and bought 22,000 acres of land in an attempt to save the property from drilling. Speaking on Democracy Now!, days after that auction, DeChristopher explained his decision to disrupt the bidding process.
I've been hoping that, someone would step up and someone would come out and be the leader, and someone would put themselves on the line and make the sacrifices necessary to get us on a path to a more livable future. I guess I just couldn't wait any longer for that someone to come out there, and had to accept the fact that that someone might be me.
Tim DeChristopher had been hoping the Obama administration would not press charges, but on Wednesday, U.S. Attorney Brett Tolman indicted DeChristopher for two felonies. If convicted, Tim faces up to 10 years in prison and a $750,000 fine. Tim DeChristopher joins us on the phone right now from Utah. Tim, were you surprised by the charges announced this week?
I was somewhat surprised by that. We didn't really see it coming, and we thought that that since the Salazar decision had pretty much decided that this was an unjust and inappropriate auction, that they weren't following their own rules, we had figured that they would probably just want to sweep this case away rather than have kind of discover all the rules that weren't followed in this case and all the corruption and manipulation involved in this auction. So I was pretty surprised that that the U.S. Attorney's Office moved on this case and is now pushing it to trial.
After the Obama administration came in and Ken Salazar became the Secretary of the Interior, didn't they he nullify or say that the land could not be sold?
Yes. All the parcels that I bid on were part of that decision. So all of those were nullified. That's why we had raised the funds to actually make the payments on there and offered that payment to the BLM. But they weren't able to accept that because of the Salazar decision, because it was all invalidated. And I think that they made that decision because they saw all the rules that the BLM didn't follow in this case, that they didn't give this auction the due process that it deserved. And so I saw that really as an official ruling that what I was standing against was something illegal and unjust. And so I was surprised that they still wanted to prosecute me for my opposition to that unjust procedure.
How much support have you received, Tim, since the December auction?
I've received a huge amount of support, really of every kind. I've received countless emails and calls from people expressing their support from around the country and around the world. I've received financial support, both back when we were trying to raise the funds to actually pay for the leases, and financial support for my legal team, and we're collecting those donations again for my legal fund through the website bidder70.org. I had my amazing legal team of Patrick Shea and Ron Yankich step up to defend me, and they're donating their time. Most importantly, I've had a huge number of people step up in solidarity of my act and say that they too share my concern for our future and see that urgent need for action, and they're willing to take those sacrifices as well. From the group that we started called Peaceful Uprising to encourage this kind of act in the future, and any kind of nonviolent direct action to defend our future from climate change. We took 30 students out to Washington, D.C. for the PowerShift conference and the Capital Climate Action. And so that was very powerful for me to see this growing and to see more people step up and starting to take risks.
Tim DeChristopher, that's probably the most important part
of the support I've received.
Tim, can you explain exactly what you were charged with?
Yes, I was charged with two counts, one of making a false statement to the government, and one of violation of the Federal Onshore Oil and Gas Leasing Reform Act, which was supposed to establish a competitive bidding process for oil and gas leases.
Tim, finally, you recently attended a 20th anniversary of the death of Edward Abbey, the author of the Monkey Wrench Gang. Can you talk about his relevance to your actions today?
I think the most powerful relevance of Edward Abbey to what I did was his statement and really his expression of the idea that sentiment without action is the ruin of the soul. Because I think that's what I had seen throughout my work as an environmentalist previous to this, where I had seen this massive crisis and massive challenge that we were facing in climate change. And I saw that my efforts of writing the letter here and there and riding my bike and things like that weren't really aligning. My actions weren't aligning with my sentiment of how serious this threat was, and I knew that. And so I felt that kind of conflict within myself. And when I stepped it up at this auction and was putting myself out there and winning all these parcels, was really the first time I felt like my sentiment or I felt like my actions were aligning with my sentiment. And I felt this tremendous sense of calm when I started doing that. Because for the first time that conflict within me was gone, and I knew that when I was standing up and risking going to prison, my actions really were aligning with how big of a crisis this is.
How do you prepare for 10 years in prison, Tim?
That's a good question. I think it's something that I've been preparing myself for, kind of by preparing myself for how severe the consequences are that we're facing by staying on the path that we're on right now. I mean, the first time that an IPCC scientist put her hand on my shoulder and said, "I'm sorry, my generation failed yours," that really shook me to the core and made me realize just how late in the game we are with dealing with climate change, and how dark and desperate of a future we might be looking at, and I think that by preparing for that completely chaotic and ugly future that we're already on track for, helps me to in prison. As something that I can deal with, because I've already started preparing myself to deal with those catastrophic effects that we might be looking at.
Well, Tim DeChrister, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Tim is a University of Utah student. He is facing two felonies, 10 years in prison, for disrupting an auction of public land last December. This is Democracy Now! We're on the road. We're in Boston, Massachusetts. Tonight, I head to South Hadley to Gamble Auditorium. Among the events there, we'll be celebrating the birthday of a 90-year-old activist named Francis Crow, who made Democracy Now! Possible throughout Western Mass by starting by hanging a hanger in her backyard to begin the broadcast until WMUA picked it up and many other TV and radio stations did in the area. And then we head back to New York tomorrow for a conference at the New School on Media Studies. I'll be speaking at 10 tomorrow morning. Tomorrow night, we'll be at Wesleyan University to celebrate one of the oldest radio stations, community radio stations in the country, WESU. It's 30th anniversary. In 1939, two Wesleyan students put wires through the gas pipes in the basement of Wesleyan to try to begin communicating with the greater community. And then on Sunday, we'll be in Kansas City celebrating KKFI. On Monday, a low-power station, WSLP. And on Monday night, we'll be celebrating the great community radio station, WMNF in Tampa, and Speak Up Tampa Bay Public Access. Then we're moving on to Asheville. North Carolina, and then to Tennessee to celebrate a great NPR station, WETS in Eastern Tennessee. We'll be in Johnson City, and that's where we'll be broadcasting from. And as we continue our community media tour, we'll be headed to Greensboro and then all through Ohio, Cleveland, and Cincinnati. We'll be broadcasting from the University of Ohio in Athens before we then head on to Montana and Idaho and all through California. Next week, we'll be celebrating the 60th anniversary of Pacifica Radio, born April 15, 1949. We'll be in Berkeley, California. And then we go on from there. Check our website at democracynow.org and check out Bill Moyers tonight. Bill Moyers Journal, I join Glenn Greenwald for an interesting conversation about independent media. But up next, just after break, Noam Chomsky for the rest of the hour. Stay with us.
Where did it all begin? When will it end? Well, it seemed like total destruction, the only solution. And there ain't no use, no one can stop her now. Ain't no use, nobody can stop them. They take a yard, give them a yard, they take a mile. Ooh. Once a man and twice a child, and everything is just for a while. It seemed like
total destruction, the only solution.
And there ain't no use, no one can stop them now.
Bob Marley, Real Situation. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We're on the road. We're in Watertown, Massachusetts. I'm Amy Goodman. President Obama and European leaders arrived in France today ahead of a key NATO summit to commemorate the 60th anniversary of the alliance. Obama will visit Germany today as well, which is also playing host to the summit. The French city of Strasbourg is under security lockdown with 25,000 police on patrol following a day of clashes between protesters and riot police. 300 people were arrested, and a German press photographer was hospitalized after being hit in the stomach by a police rubber bullet. Tens of thousands of demonstrators have descended on Strasbourg and the German towns of Kiel and Baden-Baden to protest the summit. France has temporarily reinstated border controls with Germany to restrict access to protesters. The focus of the summit will be Afghanistan, where 70,000 troops, mostly under NATO command, are at war. President Obama will use the talks to enlist support for his escalation of the war. Obama sent 21,000 extra U.S. troops to Afghanistan, is considering deploying 10,000 more. Meanwhile, Taliban militants in Pakistan marked the start of the two-day summit by destroying a fleet of 9 parked NATO vehicles in transit for Afghanistan. Last week, President Obama defended his decision to send more troops to Afghanistan.
The world cannot afford the price that will come due if Afghanistan slides back into chaos or al-Qaeda operates unchecked. We have a shared responsibility to act, not because we seek to project power for its own sake, but because our own peace and security depends on it. And what's at stake at this time is not just our own security, it's the very idea that free nations can come together on behalf of our common security.
To talk about Afghanistan, NATO, and the state of U.S. economic and military power in the world, today we're joined by one of the world's most astute thinkers and most important intellectuals of our time, linguist, philosopher, social critic, political dissident, Noam Chomsky. Noam Chomsky is a prolific author and institute professor emeritus at MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, just down the road from here, where he taught for over half a century. Among his many dozens of books are rogue states, the rule of force in world affairs, the new military humanism, lessons from Kosovo, fateful triangle, the United States, Israel, and the Palestinians, manufacturing consent, necessary illusions, thought control in democratic societies, and failed states, the abuse of power and the assault on democracy. It's a great collection of his work just out now, edited by Anthony Arnov, called The Essential Chomsky. Noam Chomsky, welcome to Democracy Now.
Very glad to be with you.
It's great to be with you here in Massachusetts in the studio instead of talking to you on the phone at home.
Yeah.
So let's start with what's happening with this NATO summit celebrating 60 years, France rejoining after more than four decades. Your analysis.
Well, the obvious question is, why bother celebrating NATO at all? In fact, why does it exist? It's 20 years now, almost, since the Berlin Wall fell. NATO was constructed on the, with the reason, whether one believes it or not, that it was going to defend Western Europe from Russian assault. Once the Berlin Wall fell and the Soviet Union was beginning to collapse, that reason was gone. So, first question, why does NATO exist? Well, in fact, the answers are interesting. Mikhail Gorbachev made a remarkable concession at that time to the United States. NATO's essentially run by the United States. He offered to allow a reunited Germany to join NATO, a hostile military alliance.
I'm going to interrupt you for a minute, Noam, because there's a lot of static on your mic, and we want to fix that. Okay. So we're going to go to a music break, and then we're going to come back to you. We're talking to Noam Chomsky. Stay with us. Thanks to Jimmy Bluestein, Jeff Grulet, and Dan Rosenberg, Shady Grove, for covering. But as Noam, you were just saying, at MIT, they have these technological problems, too. The Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
Right, the leading technological institute in the world. At commencement, the PA system almost inevitably breaks down. So this is familiar.
Briefly summarize what you were just saying, if people were having trouble hearing you through the static.
Well, I think the first question to ask about NATO is why it exists. We're now approaching the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall, unification of Germany, first steps in the collapse of the Soviet Union. Now, the alleged reason for NATO's existence was to protect the West against a Russian assault. You can believe what you like about the reason, but that was the reason. By 1989, that reason was gone. So why is there NATO? Well, that question did arise. Mikhail Gorbachev offered at that time to the United States, which runs NATO, that he would permit a unified Germany to join NATO, a hostile military alliance aimed at the Soviet Union. Now, that's a remarkable concession. If you look back at the history of the 20th century, Germany alone had practically destroyed Russia several times. And now he was offering to let a reunited, militarized Germany join a hostile military alliance backed by the most awesome military power in history. Well, there was a quid pro quo. George Bush the first was then president, James Baker, Secretary of State, and they agreed, in their words, that NATO would not expand one inch to the east, which would at least give Russia some breathing room. Now, Gorbachev also proposed a nuclear weapons-free zone from the Arctic to the Mediterranean, which would have, again, given some protection and, in fact, security for peace. Well, that was just rejected. I don't even think it was answered. Well, that's where things stood in 1989, 90. Then Bill Clinton was elected. One of his first acts was to break the promise and expand NATO to the east, which, of course, is a threat to Russian security. Now, the pretext given, for example, by his Strobe Talbot, who was the Undersecretary of State for Eastern Europe, is that that was necessary to bring the former satellites into the European Union. But that can't be. There are states inside the European Union that are not part of NATO. Austria, you know, Finland, Sweden, so that's irrelevant. But it was a threat, and Russia, of course, reacted to the hostile threat. It increased tension. Well, going up to the present, President Obama's national security advisor, James Jones, has been a strong advocate of the view that NATO should expand further to the east and to the south, and that, in fact, it should to the east and to the south means to control the energy-producing regions. The head of NATO, Dutch Secretary General De Hoop Scheffer, has advocates that NATO should take the responsibility for protecting energy supplies to the west, pipelines, sea lanes, and so on. Well, now we're getting to Afghanistan, which is right in the, has always been of great geostrategic importance because of its location. Now more than ever, because of its location relative to the energy-producing regions in the Gulf region and in Central Asia. So yes, that's what we're seeing. Actually, there's more to say about NATO, about why it exists. So we might look back, say, 10 years to the 50th anniversary. Well, the 50th anniversary of NATO was a gloomy affair. There was, right at that time, NATO was bombing Serbia illegally, as everyone admitted, claiming it was necessary for humanitarian reasons. That was at the NATO summit. There was much agonizing about how we cannot tolerate atrocities so near Europe. Well, that was an interesting comment, since at that time NATO was supporting atrocities right inside NATO. Turkey, for example, was carrying out, with massive U.S. aid, huge atrocities against its Kurdish population, far worse than anything reported in Kosovo. Right at that time in East Timor, you're not going to praise yourself, so if you don't mind, I will. At the time of the Dili massacre, which you and Alan heroically exposed, atrocities continued. And in fact, in early 1999, they were picking up again with strong U.S. support. Again, far beyond anything reported in Kosovo. That's the U.S. and Britain, you know, the core of NATO, right at the same time. In fact, Dennis Blair, President Obama, inside President Obama's national security circle, he was sent to Indonesia, theoretically, to try to get the Indonesian army to stop carrying out the mounting atrocities. But he supported them. He met with the top Indonesian general, General Wiranto, and essentially said, you know, go ahead. And they did. And in fact, those atrocities could have been stopped at any moment. That was demonstrated in September 1999, when Bill Clinton, under very extensive domestic and international pressure, finally decided to call it off. He didn't have to bomb Jakarta. He didn't have to impose an embargo. He just told the Indonesian generals the game's over, and they immediately withdrew. That goes down in history as a great humanitarian intervention. That's not exactly the right story. Right up until then, the United States was continuing to support the atrocities. Britain, under its new ethical foreign policy, didn't quite get in on time, and they kept supporting them even after the Australian-led UN peacekeeping force entered. Well, that's NATO 10 years ago. That's even putting aside the claims about Serbia, which maybe a word about those are worthwhile. We know what happened in Serbia. There's a massive, in Kosovo, there's massive documentation from the State Department, from NATO, European Union observers on the ground. There was a level of atrocities sort of distributed between the guerrillas and the Serbs, but it was expected that the NATO bombing would radically increase the atrocities, which it did. If you look back at the Milosevic indictment in the middle of the bombing, almost entirely about atrocities, except for one exception, about atrocities after the NATO bombing. That's what they anticipated. General Clark had, and commanding general, had informed Washington weeks earlier, yes, that would be the consequence. He informed the press of that as the bombing started. That was the humanitarian intervention, while NATO was supporting even worse atrocities, right within NATO, in East Timor, and go on in other cases. Well, that's NATO 10 years ago. And it begins to tell us what NATO is for. Is it for defending Europe from attack? In fact, there is such a pretense now. So when President Bush started installing missile defense systems in Eastern Europe, the claim was, well, this is to defend Europe from attack against Iranian nuclear-tipped missiles. In fact, that doesn't have any, doesn't matter. And the fact that if it had any, it would be total insanity for them to even arm one, because the country would be vaporized in 30 seconds. It's a threat to Russia again, just like Clinton's expansion of NATO to the east.
France joining?
Pardon?
France joining now, rejoining?
France joining is quite interesting. I mean, France had a policy initiated by General de Gaulle of trying to turn Europe into what was then called a third force, independent of the two superpowers. So Europe should pursue an independent course. It was, he spoke of Europe from the Atlantic to the Urals. That was a great fear of the United States since the Second World War, that Europe would strike out on its own after reconstructing, which it could. The economies on the scale of the United States, no reason, except in military force, it's comparable to the United States. So it could have been a move towards a peaceful Europe independent of the superpowers. In fact, a large part of the purpose of NATO was to prevent that from happening, to ensure that Europe would stay within the U.S. umbrella, under U.S. control. Well, France has now abandoned that position and has rejoined what is now just an intervention force, an international intervention force, exactly as James Jones and Hubschefer and others portray it. It's an international intervention force under U.S. command. Why should it exist? In fact, if you go back to 1989 and 1990, it's extremely interesting to see how the United States reacted to the collapse of the Soviet Union. So right after the fall of the Berlin Wall, which 20 years ago, which signaled the end of the Soviet Union, clearly, the Bush administration, Bush 1, immediately released the national security strategy, military budget, and so on, which are very interesting reading. What they say, in effect, is everything's going to go on exactly as before, but with new pretexts. So now we have to have a huge military establishment and military budget, and not to protect ourselves from the Russians, who are collapsing, but because, literally, because of the technological sophistication of third world powers. Now, that was promulgated without ridicule. You know, if someone was watching from Mars, they'd collapse in laughter. So because of the technological sophistication of third world powers, we have to keep this huge military budget. We have to keep intervention forces aimed at the Middle East, the main target of intervention. Why? Not because of the Russians. It said, as had been claimed, what it said was we have to direct the intervention forces to the Middle East, where our problems could not be laid at the Kremlin's door. So in other words, we've been lying to you for 50 years, but now the clouds have lifted, so we just have to have intervention forces aimed at the Middle East, because we have to control it. We have to maintain what they call the defense industrial base. That's a euphemism for high technology industry. That's why you have things like computers and the internet and so on. So that's the massive state sector of the high-tech economy. We have to maintain that, again, because of, you know, the threat of the third world and so on. In other words, everything remains the same, the pretext change. That passed without a whisper.
Noam Chomsky, I want to get to Afghanistan. It's the main topic of NATO. It's debate around the issue of the expansion of war in Afghanistan at President Obama's initiative is not the main topic of debate in the United States, meaning whether or not we should be doing this. What do you think?
Well, it's interesting. It is the topic of discussion in the United States, right in the middle of the establishment. So Foreign Affairs, the main establishment journal, had an interesting article probably 6 months ago, or roughly, by two of the leading specialists on Afghanistan, Barnett Rubin and Ahmed Rashid. And their basic point was that the United States should give up the idea that military victory is the answer to everything. They said that the United States should reorient its policy so that there would be a regional solution in which the concerned countries, that includes crucially Iran, but also India, Russia, China, would themselves work out a regional settlement, and that the Afghans should work something out among themselves. They pointed out correctly that the regional countries are not happy about having a NATO military center based in Afghanistan. It's obviously a threat to them. This is not what's being done. I mean, there's some gestures towards, you know, maybe some undersecretary will say hello to an Iranian representative or something. But that's not the core of the policy that's being pursued. Now, that side by side with that is something else that's been happening. There is a significant peace movement in Afghanistan. Exactly its scale, we don't know. But it's enough so that Pamela Constable of the Washington Post, in a recent article in Afghanistan, argued that when the new American troops come, they're going to face two enemies, the Taliban and public opinion, meaning the peace movement whose slogan is, put down the weapons and we don't mind if you're here, but for aid and development, we don't want any more fighting. In fact, we know from Western-run polls that about 75% of Afghans are in favor of negotiations among Afghans. Now, that includes the Taliban, who are Afghans. In fact, it even includes the ones in Pakistan. There's the difference. The really troubled areas now are Pashtun areas, which are split by a British-imposed line, artificial line called the Durand Line, which was imposed by the British to protect British India, expanded. And they've never accepted it. It just cuts their territory in half. Afghanistan, when it was a functioning state, never accepted it right through the 1970s. But certainly the Afghan Taliban are Afghans, and President Karzai, formerly our man, no longer, because he's just getting out of control.
How is he getting out of control?
Well, in interesting ways. When President Obama was elected, Afghan President Karzai sent him a message, which, as far as I know, was unanswered, in which he pleaded with President Obama to stop killing Afghans. He also addressed a UN delegation and told them he wanted a timetable for the removal of foreign forces. Well, his popularity quickly plummeted. He used to be very much praised for his nice clothes and great demeanor, and very much admired by the media and commentators. Now he's sunk very low. He's suddenly corrupt. And so
you mean in the Western world, the Western press?
Primarily in the United States, but in the West altogether. And it directly followed these expressions of opinion, which are very likely those of maybe a majority of Afghans, and maybe even more. In fact, he went even further. He said that he would invite Mullah Omar, the head of the Taliban, to Afghanistan to try to work out a solution. And he added, the United States isn't going to like this, but they have two choices. They can either accept it or they can throw me out, you know. And in fact, that's what they're doing. There are now plans to replace President Karzai, to sort of push him upstairs and leave him in a, it's assumed that he'll win the next election, so put him in a symbolic position and impose basically U.S.-appointed surrogate who'll essentially run the country, because that can't be tolerated. In any event, there are alternative proposals. They're discussed here. They're widely discussed in Afghanistan at the highest level and apparently among the population, to just move towards a peaceful settlement among Afghans and a regional settlement which would take into consideration the concerns of the neighboring powers.
Why do you think Obama is expanding this war, and do you call it Obama's war now?
Well, this goes way back. I mean, the United States has a sort of a comparative advantage in world affairs, namely military might, not economic power, you know, not treasury reserves. I mean, it's a very powerful state, but it's one of several. It's comparable to Europe. It's comparable to rising East Asia in, say, economic power. But in military power, it is supreme. The United States spends approximately as much of as the rest of the world in military force. It's far more technologically advanced. And when you have a comparative advantage, you tend to use it. So policy decisions tend to drift towards where you're strong, and where you're strong is military force. It's you know, the old joke, if you have a hammer, everything you see is a nail. You know? And I think that's a very much of a driving force. And there's also a long-standing imperial mentality, which says we have to control and dominate. And in particular, we have to dominate energy resources. Now, that goes way back. After the Second World War, it's been maybe the prime factor in U.S.
And the energy resources in Afghanistan?
No, they're not in Afghanistan. They're in mostly in the Gulf, secondarily in Central Asia, but Afghanistan is right in the middle of this system. I mean, there is a pipeline question. How powerful it is, you can speculate, but there have been longstanding plans for a pipeline from Turkmenistan in Central Asia to India, which would go TAPI, it's called, Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India. Now, that's of significance to the United States for a number of reasons. For one thing, if it would run right through Afghanistan and through Kandahar province, one of the most conflicted areas. If it was established, it would, for one thing, reduce the reliance of the Central Asian states on Russia, so it would weaken their role. But more significant, it would bypass Iran. I mean, India needs energy, and the natural source is Iran. And in fact, they're discussing an Iran to India pipeline. But if you could get natural gas flowing from Central Asia to India, avoiding Iran, that would support the U.S. policy, which is now very clear in Obama's case. It's been made more concrete of forming an alliance of regional states to oppose Iran. In fact, that's John Kerry, the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, recently made an important speech about that with regard to Israel-Palestine. He said we have to reconceptualize the issue so it's not an Israel-Palestine problem, but rather we'll sort of put that to the side. And what we have to do is create an alliance of Israel and what are called the moderate Arab states. And moderate is a technical term, means they do what we say. So the moderate Arab states include the brutal Egyptian dictatorship, the radical fundamentalist dictatorship in Saudi Arabia and so on. They're the moderates. And they have to join with Israel and us in an anti-Iranian alliance. And we have to, of course, break ongoing connections between Iran and India to the extent that we can and elsewhere. And that puts the Israel-Palestine problem issue to the side.
I want to get to Israel-Palestine, but we have to break. And before we do, just a quick question. Do you think Obama should pull the troops out of Afghanistan immediately?
Well, you know, I think the Afghans should make that decision.
How?
They have ways. For example, what the peace movement calls for is their traditional way of making decisions, a loya jirga, major a meeting of, you know, elders, other figures, and so on, who will try to arrive at consensus on this with all the Afghans. And it should be their decision. I mean, we have no right to be there.
We're talking to Noam Chomsky, professor emeritus at MIT, author of more than 100 books on U.S. foreign and domestic policy. We'll be back with him in a minute. Worth Sergio Mendez in Brazil 66 here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We're on the road in Boston with Professor Noam Chomsky. We're talking about, well, U.S. global policy from NATO to Afghanistan to the new government in Israel. Can you talk about Benjamin Netanyahu and what you see coming up?
Well, Benjamin Netanyahu is you can't say on the far right anymore, because the country has moved so far to the right that he's almost centrist. To the far right is his foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman, who has made his first pronouncement yesterday. He said that Israel has no responsibilities for any previous commitments. Not the Annapolis commitment to eventually form some sort of Palestinian state, unclear what, only to the roadmap. That was reported yesterday in the press. Now, what's Israel's commitment to the roadmap? He knows very well. The roadmap is the famous decision of the quartet, U.S., Europe, Russia, and the United Nations, a couple of years ago, which sort of laid out vague plans for what ought to be done. It's worth looking at them, but put that aside. Because it really doesn't matter. Because as soon as the roadmap came out, Israel formally accepted it and instantly added 14 reservations, which completely eviscerated. One of the contributions of Jimmy Carter's book on Israel-Palestine was that he was the first, I think, to give public attention to the Israeli reservations. They're in an appendix to his book, a bitterly condemned book, but nobody ever mentioned the one major contribution. In effect, Israel said, we'll sign the roadmap, but we're not going to observe it, because here's the conditions. So, for example, the one condition is that nothing can happen until the Palestinians end, of course, all violence, but also all incitement. So anything critical of Israel. On the other hand, it added nothing can stop Israel from carrying out violence and incitement. It was explicit, approximately those words. And so it continues. There can be no discussion of the existence of the settlements, in fact, no discussion of anything that matters. That's the roadmap. Now, the U.S. supported that. That means both the U.S. and Israel reject the roadmap. And Lieberman's statement yesterday is, well, that's our only commitment. If we had a functioning media, those would be the headlines. And there's much more to this. President Obama appointed a Middle East emissary, George Mitchell, who's a reasonable choice if he's allowed to do anything. So far, he's only allowed to listen to almost everyone, not everyone. For example, he's not allowed to listen to the elected government in Palestine, the Hamas-led government. Well, it would be hard to listen to them because half of them are in Israeli prisons. But nevertheless, they have voices. For example, they've supported the call for a two-state settlement that the United States and Israel have rejected. So they've joined the world on that. But why are we not allowed to listen to Hamas? Well, because they don't meet three conditions that were established. One is they have to accept the roadmap, which we in Israel reject. But they have to accept it, otherwise we can't allow them into the civilized world. The other is they have to renounce violence. Well, we don't have to discuss the question whether the United States and Israel renounce violence, so we can put that aside. A third, they have to recognize Israel. But of course, we don't have to recognize Palestine, nor does Israel. So they have to meet three conditions that we don't meet and that Israel doesn't meet. But again, that passes without comment.
What do you think President Obama's role should be right now? What do you think would be the most effective action he
could
take?
He should join the world. There has been an overwhelming international consensus for over 30 years. It was made explicit in January 1976 when the Arab states brought a resolution to the Security Council calling for the establishment of two states on the international border, which indeed, the international border up until then was recognized by the United States. It means the pre-June 67 border in official U.S. terminology when it was still part of the world in the late 60s, was with minor and mutual modifications, so maybe straighten out some curves. Almost the entire world agrees with this. It has been blocked by the United States. The United States vetoed that resolution. It vetoed a similar one in 1980. I won't run through the record, but it's essentially the same up till now. So what President Obama should do is, in fact, what President Clinton did in the last few weeks of his administration. It's important to recognize what happened then. There were negotiations in Camp David in the summer of 2000, which collapsed. Clinton blamed Arafat, the head of the Palestinian delegation, for the breakdown. But he backed off of that pretty quickly. By December, he formally recognized that the U.S.-Israeli proposals at Camp David could not be accepted by any Palestinian, and he presented what he called his parameters, somewhat vague but more forthcoming. He then made a speech, an important speech, in which he said, both sides have accepted the parameters, both sides have expressed reservations. Well, they met in Taba, Egypt, in January 2001, both sides, to iron out the reservations. And they came very close to an agreement, which was very close to the international consensus.
We're just wrapping up right now, but I want to ask if you support a one- or two-state solution there.
Nobody supports. I mean, you can talk about a one-state solution if you want. I think a better solution is a no-state solution. But this is pie in the sky. If you're really in favor of a one-state solution, which in fact I've been all my life, except the binational state, not one state, you have to give a path to get from here to there. Otherwise, it's just talk. Now, the only path anyone has ever proposed is through two states as the first stage.
Professor Noam Chomsky, our guest. Part two of our conversation, which will play next week, will be on the global economic meltdown. Noam Chomsky, Professor Emeritus at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. We're broadcasting from Boston. I'm Amy Goodman. Our website, democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.